This is Free Speech Radio News, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on the program, residents in the Gaza Strip celebrate a new ceasefire deal. We'll see what's happening at the crossings and in the schools. A law set to take effect on Monday in Texas will close down more than 95% of the state's abortion clinics unless a court rules otherwise. And longtime Indian hunger striker and human rights activist Irom Sharmila has been rearrested just days after her release from 14 years in detention. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. A ceasefire deal between Hamas and Israel reached earlier this week seems to be holding. When news of the deal broke, Gazans took to the streets in celebration. Afterward, many began to grapple with the reality of trying to reclaim some semblance of normal life. The ceasefire provides for more open border crossings and gives the Palestinian Authority control of both the borders and of Gaza reconstruction projects. The agreement also slightly expands the fishing area off the Gaza coast and narrows the so-called buffer zone along the border fence. FSRN's Gaza-based Rami El-Maghari joins us. Rami, first, the deal. What did Gazans really get here? Do more border crossings actually mean more goods getting into the territory?
The ceasefire agreement stipulated gradually, ending the siege gradually of Gaza. Israel allowed more people to cross into the areas, a checkpoint to the north of the Gaza Strip, and also the continuity of the shipments of goods from Israel into the Gaza Strip via the crossing Kerem Shalom in the south of the territory. And I do not see any kind of reopening of the other crossings. We had about 60 crossings in Gaza. Still, so far, none of these crossings have reopened except the one in the north, which is Erez, and the one in the north, the south, which is the Kerem Shalom.
Rami El-Maghari, with hundreds of thousands of people still sheltering in UN-run schools, what's the status of school for Gazan students?
UNRWA, which is the main service provider in the Gaza Strip, United Nations Works and Redefinition for Palestine Refugees, is going to reopen the schools, even amidst the people being sheltered in these schools, in 1 week after the ceasefire. It will open the schools on three-shift basis. For example, as thousands of people who have been displaced in the UNRWA schools will remain in these schools, and the UNRWA will enable the students to go to normal school times by having the same school working for three shifts a day. Also, the UNRWA is going to have the schools reopened for about 2 weeks after they will reopen, to give the students some sort of special non-curricular activities in order for them to enable the children to debrief out of the a high amount of suffering, stress, and trauma they had endured during the recent Israeli attacks on Gaza, which lasted about 51 days.
What about the thousands of people still suffering from injuries? Clearly, local hospitals can't currently meet their needs. Are they able to travel for medical care outside of Gaza?
Hundreds of people are being treated now in outside of the territory, in hospitals in Cairo, hospitals in Jordan, hospitals in Turkey, and even in Germany. And some European countries have expressed the willingness to welcome many of these injured people into their countries for treatment. But as you said, the hospital situation in Gaza is so desperate to give or to provide medical care for the injured people whose injuries are very serious, and hospitals in Gaza cannot cope with the seriousness of these injuries.
FSRN's Rami El-Maghari lives in and reports from the Gaza Strip. President Obama issued executive orders this week that seek to broaden the recent VA overhaul bill. The actions include changes in mental health care services and more financial supports for vets. But in light of a new report also out this week detailing the recent scandal involving egregious wait times at the Veterans Affairs Hospital in Phoenix, watchdog groups are skeptical these new changes will do any good. Ashley Westerman reports from Washington, D.C.
You actually are standing in my living room. This is where I live at, on the street.
That's Samuel Hinton, a thin black man of 57. His hair is beginning to gray, but his eyes are an eerie, dull blue. He and his fiancée live under the Silver Spring Metro Station, right on the Washington, D.C., Maryland border. Hinton, originally from Atlantic City, New Jersey, served in the Army in Vietnam. Now he's homeless and has been for almost 20 years.
I do a little something here, get on my feet there, and then again, crash again. So my life been basically like a roller coaster.
Hinton says during the days he's here, making about $15 a day asking for money.
Bless you, brother.
At night, he sleeps wherever someone won't bother him. He doesn't do shelters. He says his post-traumatic stress disorder, psychosis, and manic depressive disorder won't allow him to tolerate a small room full of people. He tried to seek help through the Veterans Affairs here in D.C., but his claim was turned down. Hinton says it was because he didn't seek treatment while he was still on active duty.
How's that so? How do I walk through the military and not tell nobody about none of my illness? Okay? You have to get in that system to be able to move in that system. And right now, I'm not able to get in that system because I'm not in the system no more.
One of the 19 executive actions President Obama announced on Tuesday aims to keep veterans from falling through the cracks like Hinton. Here's President Obama at the American Legion National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, touting the new in-transition program.
And we're going to make it easier for service members being treated for mental health conditions to continue their care as they transition to the VA. So automatically connecting them with the support they need, making sure they don't lose access to any medications they may be taking.
Obama's other initiatives to help veterans' mental health include forming a peer group support for vets with mental illnesses, hiring more doctors, and increasing funds for brain injury studies. There are also a couple that aim to provide housing and jobs. Joshua Stewart, political assistant director with the National Coalition of Homeless Veterans, says providing a continuum of care as vets leave the service is really important.
Then we can catch these problems early. We can give these people help that they need before, they do become homeless. It's all about intervening early and helping early.
The National Coalition of Homeless Veterans says a presence of mental disorders ranging from substance abuse to mental illness are risk factors for vets to become homeless. Stewart notes Obama also did announce a one-third drop in homeless veterans since 2010 and says these actions further chip away at this issue. On the very same day Obama announced these initiatives, the Inspector General of the VA released a report that backed up claims of significant delays to medical care in the veterans' health care system and evidence that staff manipulated wait times on reports to hide delays. The previous IG probe also found that 40 veterans died waiting for care at facilities in Phoenix, Arizona, but stopped short of attributing their deaths to the wait, saying they found no, quote, conclusive link. The scandal cost former VA Secretary Eric Shinseki his job and led to Congress passing a $16 billion reform package. Concerned Veterans for America senior advisor Darren Selnick says a non-conclusive finding is government speak for we don't want to be sued. He says what's really disappointing is that the VA also does a yearly performance and accountability report that's pretty much the same thing.
You know, we caught you again. Yes, we're making corrective actions. It won't happen again. And then there's no follow-up, no one's punished, and so it happens over and over and over again.
Back underneath the Silver Spring Metro Station, homeless veteran Samuel Hinton agrees. What Obama is doing sounds good.
But how is that still going to help me? Because the people that's working behind them desks, they don't give a damn about me. Okay, they don't think about their paycheck. They don't give a damn about us.
According to this week's IG report, the FBI is going to investigate now nearly 100 VA medical facilities for potential criminal activity. Ashley Westerman, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Reproductive rights advocates have been in the streets in Louisiana and Texas this week, protesting laws that could shutter nearly all health clinics providing abortion services in their respective states. Barring court intervention, the laws take effect on Monday. In Louisiana, clinic physicians would be required to have hospital admitting privileges. A federal appeals court overturned a similar law in Mississippi last month, but in that case, the state's only abortion provider would have been forced to shutter, leaving women there with no options. In Texas, the law goes further, and much of it has already taken effect. The last piece is a mandate that abortion clinics meet the same strict standards as same-day surgical centers. We're joined by Andrea Grimes, senior political reporter at RH Reality Check. Andrea Grimes with RH Reality Check. Now, what about the cost of abortion? I assume these new requirements drive up the costs of services at clinics that do stay open, putting services out of reach for many women who may otherwise have access to the remaining clinics.
Right. So all of the legal abortion providers that will exist after September 1st will be located in Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, and San Antonio, which, if you know anything about the geography of Texas, means that they are located along the I-35 and I-45 corridors in the eastern portion of the state. So that leaves the Rio Grande Valley. You know, that's a several hours drive from San Antonio. We're talking 4 or 5 hours in traffic. Maybe folks in East Texas driving 3-4 hours maybe to Houston or to Dallas-Fort Worth, folks in Lubbock, Midland, Odessa driving, you know, maybe 4 or 5 hours to Fort Worth. So you know, we're really looking at a severe reduction in access. The numbers play out such that if there are 8 abortion clinics left in Texas, that's one clinic to serve about every 1 million people who might be pregnant at any given time.
Andrea Grimes with RH Reality Check. Now, what about the cost of abortion? I assume these new requirements drive up the costs of services at clinics that do stay open, putting services out of reach for many women who may otherwise have access to the remaining clinics.
Well, you know, the cost of the procedure itself actually does not go up a terrific amount. The cost of abortion generally has not inflated a great deal since the 70s, particularly compared to other medical procedures or other things like cars or homes. What really increases in terms of price is just this thing of getting to a clinic. We're talking about gas, airfare, bus fare, hotel overnight stay, finding childcare for children. We know that people who get abortions, 2/3 of them already have children at home, so they're going to have to find childcare for their kids. So it's really these added costs of travel that are going to affect the cost for folks coming in from out of town.
Therefore, who's hardest hit?
Low-income people, people of color, queer and trans folks who already have a really hard time accessing reliable, high-quality reproductive health care. You know, we're really talking about the most marginalized populations being the most significantly affected.
If the law takes effect on Monday, what's next for folks fighting for access to reproductive health services in Texas?
Most likely, we will see an appeal to the Fifth Circuit, which is the federal court in New Orleans, which is kind of notoriously anti-choice. Many of the judges on that court have ruled in favor of very stringent abortion restrictions in the past. It may go to the Supreme Court. In the meantime, a lot of folks are working really hard through abortion funds and other kind of access points on the ground. Folks are doing a lot of activism. They're registering a lot of people to vote.
Andrea Grimes is a senior political reporter at rhrealitycheck.org. She joined us from Austin, Texas. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. You'll find more of our work, along with information about how you can support it, at fsrn.org. Since the Central African Republic, or CAR, gained independence from France in 1960, there have been 8 coups. The security situation in the country has deteriorated during years of war, and hundreds of thousands of people displaced by violence have fled the country. The most recent fighting has been between remnants of the predominantly Muslim Seleka rebels and the largely Christian and animist anti-Balaka militias. Despite a shaky peace deal between the two groups signed in July, refugees continue to stream into neighboring Cameroon. The journey between countries is long and made mostly on foot. Those who survive the trek arrive weak and exhausted. Once in Cameroon, they face a different set of challenges, including malnourishment and police brutality. FSRN's Ngala Kilianchimpton traveled to Cameroon's eastern borders, the main entry point for the refugees, and files this report.
Yvette Farandongo weeps in front of her tent in Giwa Yangambo, a refugee camp in Cameroon's eastern region. She has just lost one of her children, a two-year-old daughter she had managed to save from the raging war in her own country, the Central African Republic. But the child couldn't survive the malnutrition suffered during 30 days of trekking through the forest in search of peace and safety in neighboring Cameroon. She died barely a week after arriving in Garoua Boulaye in Cameroon's eastern region.
We are fleeing death. My son here got a bullet in the thigh. He's 22 years old. My younger sister was killed, a five-year-old girl killed just like that. We can't stay in a place like that. We are running for our lives. You have the Salika and the Anti-Balaka. Muslims have no love for Christians and vice versa. That's what worsened everything.
Almost every refugee here has a story of the horror and pain of losing loved ones in fleeing the conflict. Francis Ndengo crossed the border to Cameroon, but arrived bearing the mental scars of trauma.
When I arrived here, I learned that my cousin had been shot, and I also found out that what remained of my family sought refuge in the Bengui Bimbo St. Mark Major Seminary. When you are in a situation like that, you think only about your own survival, so everyone fled to separate destinations.
The United Nations High Commission for Refugees says the influx of refugees into Cameroon has dropped slightly from 10,000 people a week to slightly over 8,000 people. But some attribute the drop to the inability of those suffering from malnutrition to make the long and difficult journey to Cameroon, rather than an abating of fighting in the Central African Republic. UNHCR field officer Constancia Teribe says her organization, along with other aid agencies, has been struggling as best they can to treat the exhausted and malnourished refugees.
Lately, we have some people coming with malnutrition mainly, but because of with the help of our partners, we are working on this and we are trying to recover all these people because they have been traveling for a long time, maybe weeks, or some of them they have been walking through the forest, so they come exhausted and they come with some health issues.
The life for refugees from CAR here is made worse by locals who exploit them and security forces who wield their power over them. Francis Ndengo explains.
La difficulté majeure que nous rencontrons, c'est la libre circulation, il n'y a pas.
We don't have freedom of movement. Security forces won't accept the food rationing card as identification, which is the only document the UNHCR gave us. When you get to a checkpoint and present the card, they tell you that you caused trouble. Either they ask you to pay bribes, or tell you to go back, or even throw you into jail, where it's only the UNHCR that would negotiate your release. This is our major problem here. But there is also a lot of exploitation, because people hire us to work on their farms, and once the work is done, they often won't pay.
The refugees want the UNHCR to issue them refugee identification cards, which will allow them to move around the country with greater ease. But Constancia Teribe says it could be a long and convoluted process.
There's a very young operation, and to issue the refugee card, it takes time because it needs to be agreed with the Cameroon government.
Despite all these problems, many of the refugees here don't think they will return to their home country anytime soon. Instead, many here look forward to integrating into the larger Cameroonian society. But to do this, they need basic revenue on which to survive. While the number of refugees flooding into Cameroon from the Central African Republic has declined since 2013, the UNHCR estimates more than 200,000 are currently in Cameroon. Of that number, many plan to stay for the foreseeable, yet uncertain future. Ngala Kilianchimpton,
FSRN, Giwa Yangambo, Cameroon.
Authorities in India's northeastern state of Manipur have again arrested noted human rights activist Arom Sharmila just 2 days after her court-ordered release. Sharmila has been on hunger strike for 14 years, demanding revocation of a draconian law that gives sweeping powers to Indian security forces to fight separatist movements. Sharmila is being held at a hospital for force-feeding. As Bismillah Gilani reports, the arrest has evoked strong criticism and renewed calls for repealing the law that many believe encourages human rights abuses.
Barely 40 hours after Arom Sharmila's release, dozens of police women arrived at the protest site, where the 42-year-old activist had continued her hunger strike, surrounded by supporters. The officers grabbed Sharmila's arms and legs and took her, almost dragging her, into a police vehicle. Sharmila and her supporters resisted, shouting, "You can't do this. It's illegal." But she was taken back to the hospital, where she has been force-fed through a nasal tube for 14 years. Local activist Bablu Loithingam says it was shocking to watch.
They treat her as if she's a wild animal who is going to bite you, or some kind of a terrorist who is going to take out a gun and shoot you or something. And the amount of force that they use, she ended up, you know, her whole nail started coming out, her right toe was bleeding, and her clothes were dropping. Even the brutal colonial British who were colonizing this country and sucking this country out didn't arrest Mahatma Gandhi when he was doing hunger strike. They never called him criminal. They respected him.
Once again, police charged Sharmila with attempted suicide. The court that ordered her release earlier this month had dismissed the same charge, finding that her political protest was not necessarily an attempt to kill herself. Ravi Nitesh is coordinator of the Save Sharmila Solidarity Campaign.
It is a mockery of our judicial system. We knew that the government would do something to keep her away from the public because people were rallying around her and she has the potential to build a strong movement against the draconian laws. But we did not expect that it would violate the judiciary like this.
Arom Sharmila began her fast in 2000 against India's Armed Forces Special Powers Act, or AFSPA. Speaking to journalists after her release last week, she reiterated her stand that she would end the fast only after the law is repealed.
Until and unless my demand is fulfilled, I will not touch anything else through my mouth. It is my right. No, I will not take anything else.
The law gives impunity to Indian security forces operating in areas declared as disturbed. Under this law, a soldier has the power to search, arrest, and even shoot a person on the mere suspicion of being a militant. The law is currently in effect in India's northeastern states and in Indian administered region of Kashmir, where armed insurgencies against Indian rule are ongoing. In all these areas, human rights abuses alarmingly increased after the law was introduced, and human rights groups have for long demanded a repeal. Raghu Menon is senior policy advisor with the Amnesty International India.
There have been so many commissions appointed by the Supreme Court and by the federal government, which themselves have said, you know, that that this law should go. I think that, if anything, should be the starting point for this new government, which has just taken over charge over 100 days ago, to, you know, set in motion a process that will take into account the concerns raised by people of great integrity, respect, and experience, you know, who appointed by the government raised red flags as well. So it's not just activists who are saying this.
The now ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, has in the past opposed the idea of repealing the law. As a government, however, the party's policy on the issue remains to be seen. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
Funeral services were held Monday for Michael Brown, the unarmed black youth shot at least 6 times and killed by a white Ferguson, Missouri police officer. Thousands of people, including local residents, community leaders, and national civil rights and political figures, attended the services. Brown's family asked for a day of reprieve from the protests held in response to the young man's death, and calm has largely followed. Law professors from nearby St. Louis University are calling on local officials to grant clemency to thousands of protesters who were arrested on nonviolent offenses. For weeks, the media was flooded with images of the protesters who were met by a militarized police force armed with high-powered automatic weapons and tanks. But as the protests ebb, so does the media presence in Ferguson. Mumia Abu-Jamal comments on the aftermath of the protests and reporting in the Missouri town.
Post-Ferguson, as the body of Michael Mike Brown is consigned to the earth, network newscasters and broadcasters are packing their gear, canceling their hotel rooms, and setting their sights on new wonders, new images, and new stories. That the tragic saga in Ferguson struck national news desks is both rare and unprecedented, given the length and depth of the story. But to reporters, stories come and stories go. And the Brown story is going. Part of the reason is the incessant media chorus for the expulsion of so-called outside agitators, seen as the violence-prone troublemakers coming on the scene. Once gone, tension drained away like an unwanted migraine. And tension, in the words of Martin Luther King Jr., creative tension, is the stuff that animates protests and helps fuel movements. It is the job of the managerial class of lawyers, preachers, and politicians to reduce tensions, to de-radicalize movements, to make them manageable. And once they become manageable, they lose their mass base, and with it, its social power. For the masses know the essential nature of the police, for they see them and gauge them daily. They know them as violent, vicious, and venal government officials, and they are hungry, anxious to oppose them. Movements are a lot like volcanoes, which appear dormant or sleeping. Unseen or underground forces churning, boiling, crashing like waves against a hidden shore. Until one day, usually a day none had foreseen, it erupts, splashing its red molten rage over miles, changing everything. That's what movements do and what they are. If hot enough, they can change everything. Everything. But political, media, and state forces don't want change. They want continuity, for therein lies both their profits and their power. And who wants to lose either of those things? Therefore, the tragedy of Ferguson will be stuffed back into the pillow of forgetfulness. Until next time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by the radio stations that carry our show and by listeners like you. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.